This is the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast with Gary Taylor.
Welcome to another edition of the AMHT Podcast. You have joined us at a milestone moment, for it is our 50th episode. To mark this special occasion, I am at Aston Martin Agonda at Gaydon. And with me is someone I believe who is also marking a milestone, being 20 years at AML. He started in May 2005 as Director of Design and is now Chief Creative Officer and Executive Vice President. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Absolutely. Perfect. He is, of course, as you may have heard, Marek Reichman. Hello, Marek.
Hello. Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks very much for your time. Yeah. So that's quite a grand title there. What does that involve in reality?
First, if I could say congrats on the anniversary of podcasts as well, because I think it's important to share things.
So, all right. Well, thank you very much. Yes, yeah. Yes. Some wondered if we ever get to 50, but here we are.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, they're grandiose titles, I guess, if you narrow one down, I draw cars for a living and we create cars, but it's become Chief Creative Officer because we have expanded well outside just the pure parameters of cars. As you know, we are apartments in Miami, personal homes in Tokyo, bicycles, prams recently,
yes,
watch
that.
Connection.
I'm trying to justify the pram.
all of the connections with the merchandise that we do and Formula One. So that if you like, cross product branding and design is my responsibility, and the dealerships, which is why we were able to expand out into personal homes and the Miami residences, because we've designed all the dealerships. Q New York has, for instance, probably one of the latest. And then Executive Vice President, I guess because I've been here so long, know so many people and know so much of the process.
So you automatically by default become a Vice President?
By default.
After 20 years.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's not too shabby. Any more money for that?
Well, unfortunately not.
Okay.
I do it for the love of it.
Lovely. Yeah. Well, we're in your office. And I will say it's quite busy in here. We've got a bike. We've got various Aston models. We've got a Porsche.
Yeah. 917.
917.
Yeah.
Got some models of some Astons on there.
There's a future. This is a printed SLA future product.
So okay.
Luckily the listeners can't see it.
Can't see it. Oh, look at that. Wonderful. Okay. Yeah. Is this your sanctuary?
I would say so, yeah.
Away from the meetings and the...
Yeah. I think, you know, there's space to do a sketch. If I need, I can close the door and do a sketch and get away from it. My job is a highly visual job, and I understand policies within companies about clean desks and nothing around you, et cetera, but when your life and job is about creating something that doesn't exist, then inspiration becomes a big part of my daily life. And obviously there's an array of books behind you that go from wooden boats to past historical cars to carrozzeria to art to architecture, fashion, things that I need sometimes as reference or sometimes to draw upon, because icons exist in all spheres. And then obviously behind me here, just an array of imagery, because color is a very, very important part of what we do as well. And I think image and inspiration are fundamental. And then some of the things that I love, that I like as models, 917, as mentioned, is probably one of the most iconic racing cars. Incredibly innovative. And because of all of the innovation, has an unbelievable form and shape. I'm inspired by many, many things, but sometimes I need them around me. I need to touch, feel, see, and the bit you haven't noticed is my very, very nice green teapot. So Japanese tea, perfect. Green teapot, because I'm a green tea drinker, and I love it. And that was a gift from a well-known Japanese designer.
Can we go back to your early career, your early life? Where did this come from, all this inspiration, the love of artistic skills? Your father, who was Polish, your mother was English, and he was a blacksmith. Did it arise from there?
Yeah, I have an older brother as well who is also very much in the car world. He restores cars and, in fact, has spent many years restoring some of Lawrence Stroll's cars. And I guess having an older brother and a father who was a maker of things, an older brother who was into cars, my father's closest friend was also a very, very skilled mechanic. And I spent my young days, you know, at Uncle Ziggy's house, looking at cars in his workshop, just being inspired by them, and then seeing my dad literally take a billet of steel and with his bare hands and a bit of heat create something. And I was always fascinated by...
How old would you have been then?
Oh, probably 7 or 8 or 9.
Informative years.
Yeah, yeah. And it, later on, I discovered more and more, obviously, but it was all kind of ingrained in me then that you make things and you can make things from an idea in your head or from a drawing. So I was fascinated with how do you think about making something? What's the process in someone's head to create something? And I was an incredible tinkerer. I would always take things apart to try and figure out how they were made, how many parts, why. I always put them back together. It's then when you begin to realize that there's a skill set in there, because I could take something apart and actually, without instruction, remember how it would go back together. And I was fascinated by part lines and shut lines and is it in, I mean, imagine being 10 or 11, probably then later on, and thinking about why something's injection molded or not, or pressed, or why isn't it in a different material? And again, going on from what my father did and my brother's studies, because he was studying design as well, but I was also very lucky to grow up in Sheffield, very close to Hathersage. And I was a cyclist and was able to go out to see David Meller's studio out in Hathersage, where you could actually physically go and see professional designers drawing and creating objects in a crucible studio. And so I was just fascinated by that. How do you get a blank piece of paper?
Yes.
Put something on it.
Put something
and make it.
Now,
And that became and is my life, you know, ever since.
Well, clearly no regrets on that, because you wanted to be an industrial designer.
I did, yeah.
And so the education path went to Teesside University, wasn't
That's
it?
That's correct,
and
yeah.
And then got a BA First Class Honours in Industrial Design.
Correct.
And then off you pop to, as probably... the infamous Royal College of Art.
Yeah. So again, I wanted to study design in general. So my absolute passion, obviously, is cars, our cars. Any form of transportation, I'm fascinated with what it's done for society, how much culture exists around the car, and many other forms of transportation as well. It's not just the car.
It is quite incredible. You look about 100 years. I've read a book by L.J.K. Setwright about the cars. It's been staggering.
Yeah.
The infrastructure, the movement of people. I mean, you just couldn't imagine it, really.
You can't imagine it. And still today, we continue to develop more brands, create more cars. Obviously now looking at different, you know, forms of propulsion in terms of petrol, out to electrification and all the hybrid forms of that, and hydrogen, et cetera, et cetera. So there is at no point in society where we've said, well, the car's a pretty bad old idea. We need to do X. We are still fascinated with this personal form of transportation. So for me, it was inevitable. that I would go into cars, but I wanted to study the core principles of industrial design. So that's how do you make something? How is it manufactured? Understand the science behind materiality, understand the science behind the physics of an object and why it has to be, and function. So that was the core learning as an industrial designer. And I really enjoyed my time up in Teesside, a great group of colleagues that I'm still very much in touch with as well. And a group of us then were successful in getting to the RCA to study automotive design. So I went from the, if you like, the generic field of design, which I wanted to understand more, to a very focused 2 years studying at the Royal College. And again, I think my years of education, they were unbelievable. You know, yeah. A kid from Sheffield with a blacksmith who was a father, going further up north, which was great, but then going into the heart of London for 2 years, that is a massive eye-opener.
You seem very excited by the origins of this. You seem very grateful for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I am. I think it was a huge opportunity and I grasped the nettle, you know. I had a lot of fun at university and at the RCA, but I graduated with a first class honors degree with merits. I graduated from the RCA with the highest possible degree. I actually won the Fleur Coles Award for best student in the Royal College of Art. So I didn't come out of those places without giving it my all. I literally gave everything that I possibly could and learned as much as I possibly could. I still spend each day learning now because I think I love the process of learning, of understanding, of discovering newness. And if you stop learning and stop having an open mind to something new, then, you know, it's probably time to give up being a designer.
It's all about curiosity, isn't it?
Yeah.
You say grasping the nettle.
Yeah.
Eric, in my research, you've had a fascinating career at Aston Martin. A lot of people are listening to this are hopefully Aston Martin owners and enthusiasts and aware of you and they think, Eric, Aston Martin, but you've had a fascinating career before Aston Martin.
Yeah.
I've got here you began your designer career at Rover Cars in 1991.
Yes, correct.
And then what was the first job there? Was it steering wheels or wing mirrors or something? It's usually humble like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, interesting. If I go back, there are many firsts in my career and my pathway. So I was actually the first and last ever Land Rover sponsored student at the Royal College of Art. Not because I was bad, but when I finished at the Royal College, Land Rover and Rover had merged into one studio, so they never had a Land Rover only student again. And I became part of the overall Rover team. So it was combined Land Rover and Rover. And my first very, very first job was actually on a Land Rover product, and it was to do the rear wheel trim on the first generation Discovery, the one that says Discovery.
Yes.
So that was mine. There you go. Famous.
Perfect. In 1995, you moved to California at BMW's Design Works. You became a senior designer.
Yeah.
So with BMW, they had Land Rover under their belt at the time.
Yeah.
And Rolls-Royce.
Yeah. So they basically came in and swooped up Land Rover, Rover, Mini at the time as well. Austin Healey, Woolsey, Triumph, I believe, as well. So quite a few British brands.
Yeah.
Rolls-Royce was slightly later, but in scooping them up, they had an idea to generate, obviously, knowledge. So acquire knowledge for all-wheel drive systems, Land Rover, for front-wheel drive systems, Mini.
Because they were purely rear-wheel drive.
Because they were only rear-wheel drive at the time. And we hadn't, so it then went from only Land Rover to Land Rover and Rover for myself and some of the other brands I just mentioned, to BMW ownership, and internally we had a design competition to look at what became the first BMW discovery, and it was called at the, well, I'll remember the name of the project at some point, L51, I think, was the title of it. It was called Heartland, and it was all about recreating the heartland of Land Rover, but out in California from a California perspective. So, of course, I grasped that nettle because that was going to be a six-month project out in California. And after 10 years, I decided to come back from California. So I won the competition, went out there. We developed the car. It was presented to Reitzler. Reitzler then said, I love it. I would like you to look at doing a Range Rover because we want to start with Range Rover and a Defender as well.
That was not the relaunch or certainly a new design language for Range Rover.
Yeah,
where
absolutely. That, much more architectural, far more product.
L322 I've got down here.
Yeah, was,
big one
was the Range Rover. Yeah. So if you like, the first generation of BMW Range Rover. So what are we now? That's three generations ago, I think. Yeah.
So you're there. Also behind the Rolls-Royce Phantom.
They acquired Rolls-Royce in 1999 or 98 and were not under the contract limitations, were not actually allowed to show anything to the general public until 2002, I think. So I, again, submitted an idea to, at the time, it was Wolfgang Reitzler, on how we should design and create Rolls-Royce as a brand, where we should do it. And that was in London. I won the briefing, if you like, so I led the team. And we started in an old bank on the Bayswater Road, number 54 Bayswater Road, right next to the Lancaster Gate Hotel. And that became our Rolls-Royce secret design studio. And all of the ideation and ideas for Phantom started there. And obviously Phantom was then launched in 2002, I believe, or 2003.
Sounds
maybe.
About right, yeah.
Yeah. But no, that it was great. So again, I kind of became a specialist in the British brands within within the BMW group because I'd gone from a suite of product for Land Rover. And I was under a lot of pressure to go and deliver the Discovery and go to Munich and deliver it. But I was so tied to my beach and the ocean in California that I said, you know what, I'd like to stay out here and someone can run that. So I did a lot of flying back and forth to Munich to look at that. And at that point, Reitzler said to me, I'm Bangle, you need to put in an idea for Rolls-Royce, and we want you to do Rolls-Royce. So,
well, with these behind you and your refresh of British icons, if you like, it's probably of no surprise if we jump to Aston Martin. When you got a request, and I'll come on to how it happened, from Dr. Ulrich Betz.
Correct.
Now, and I said in the introduction, you've been here 20 years. What we've decided to do, Marek, and dear listener, is we're going to do several podcasts and we're going to split them into eras because there's a lot to go through here.
Yeah.
Does it seem like 20 years?
No, it doesn't. I guess if you love something, it goes like that.
Yeah. So we're going to cover various eras and we could do those in later podcasts. So the first era is going to be 2005 to 2014, Aston Martin, under the leadership of Ulrich Betz, and I think David Richards was the chairman then.
That's right, yeah.
And as some context, just before all that, Ford were unloading the Premier Automotive Group.
Yeah.
Decided to diverse themselves, Ford.
Yeah.
So Jaguar, Land Rover, Volvo and Aston Martin were disposed of, if you like.
Yeah. And Mazda.
Lincoln.
Yeah. No, Lincoln remained within Ford. After the BMW era and Rolls-Royce and the Phantom, again, I was in this quandary of, I now have to stay in Europe and in Munich to deliver Phantom. So I got it to a point where the car kind of looked as you would see the original Phantom, but wanted to go back to California. This time, BMW were not so happy for me to do that. And I was headhunted by Ford to go out to California to basically create Lincoln and Mercury as competitor to Europe's, let's call them premium brands, to BMW itself and to Mercedes. And at the time, Audi was not as we know Audi today. So back to California with Ford, but doing Lincolns and Mercuries. And that's how I ended up then in the Ford family, noticed by Ulrich when he was without a design director. He'd spotted me and said...
Well, I'm always fascinated by this. How were you approached? Were there faxes then? I don't know.
there were, and we just got over faxes. Yeah. I was approached because my internal boss, if you like, who I reported to in America, and by now I'd gone to Dearborn, so sadly I'd left my beat in California because I'd gone up the ladder and I was a director of... all of the interiors for Ford materials and the chief designer for Lincoln and Mercury. And I had to be in Dearborn, therefore. My boss was Jay Mays, very well-known designer, who I owe a lot of my success to, I must say, because he was a designer's designer. And he's very supportive in the community of designers and probably kind of made car designers quite famous in a way. And he, in me going to Detroit, said, look, I know it's Detroit. I know it's tough. I need somebody here. I need to kind of grow the vision of design in Detroit for Ford. And you're the person I'd like to start that kind of process with. And if you come out here, I promise you that you'll have one of the brands that Ford owns. And you'll run that brand, whether that is Mazda, Volvo, Aston Martin, et cetera, et cetera. So I nudged him. He said 2 years. I think I nudged him after 18 months. And he said, it's not been 2 years, has it? I said, oh, yes, it has. he then put me in touch with the CEOs of Volvo and of Aston Martin. So I went out to Volvo, interviewed very well there, went out to Aston Martin, met Ulrich for the first time. And Ulrich is, as you know, a very interesting character and was very persuasive. I actually really enjoyed my time out in going to meet the CEO of Volvo and the place. And this, it's again, Volvo and the state of Volvo, it's a designer's design company. Yes. It's Swedish design at the core.
I think that's pretty well established.
Really, really, really well established. And I said, I came back and I said, I love it. I'd love to take the job out in Volvo. And Jay then said to me, well, you've had another inquiry from Aston Martin and Ulrich Beck. So I want you to go fly and see him. And bearing in mind, I lived in Michigan. So that was my life. I'd been there for 10 years by then in the US. And I met Ulrich. We had half an hour set, and I thought, you know, half an hour is not long enough to go in, and took my portfolio in as advised. Ulrich spent 2 hours telling me about stuff and hardly listening to myself.
Well, entirely surprised, because we did a bit of a podcast a couple of episodes ago with the Vantage Celebration Day, and very grateful to grab 20 minutes with him, and he seemed very passionate about design and what he wanted and what he saw for Aston Martin.
Again, brilliant visionary as a CEO and engineer as well. Yeah. And so he spent 2 hours, so an hour and a half over the time, and then finally said, oh yeah, let's have a look at your portfolio. So I showed him what I'd done, and he asked me straight away to do some sketches for a four-door car. We started having that conversation about Rapide, and I looked at him and I said, well, that's if I take the job. And I think his response was, what do you mean if? And I said, well, I have other options also. And it kind of ended a bit sourly because I didn't say, sure, I'll do it. So I got out of the office, got back on a plane, came over, met with Jay, said, how did it go? I said, well, I'm not sure. It went really well. And then it was a bit of a blunt ending. And he said, oh, That's strange because he's been on the phone and I've got several emails saying, when can you start? I said, well, I didn't agree to go to Aston Martin. He said, well, we'd better let Volvo know you're not going because I think you need to take the Aston job. And of course, I was over the moon. I, you know, went home and just was like, wow, I'm going to be the boss of Aston Martin Design. So I then had to phone Ulrich to tell him I was coming. And this is how the conversation went. Ah, yeah. Hello, Marek. Yeah, good to meet you. I would like you to come and start. I said, well, that's brilliant. I have a few projects in America I need to wrap up and finish, and Jay's expecting me to finish them. I've got to move all my things. So probably over the next 2 months, 10 weeks, I can make the transition.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. He said, how about 3 weeks? And I said, I'm not sure I can actually move my whole life in 3 weeks. He said, ah, okay, I will help you. And that was it. 3 weeks later, I arrived in Gaydon, and I've been here since, if you like.
So. And also, I think there was some urgency behind this Rapide, or this four-door Aston sketch. You said, could you do something for us? Yeah. And you said it was going to be X period, and he said...
Yeah, he said, I would like to see some drawings tomorrow. So I spent the whole evening sketching, and at the time, it was more difficult, obviously, to transfer imagery. So figuring out how to get him good images, high-quality resolution images. And before I even got to the UK, he and I were discussing designs for Rapide, over the telephone, over whatever way we could. So that was it. Before I even knew it, I was already embroiled. I was here.
You was here.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying on the podcast two or three episodes ago, he met you with you every day.
Yes.
I'm sure you enjoyed that.
I couldn't escape him.
No, yeah. It's great to have that enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Also, there wasn't a design studio, was there?
Gary, you took my point. When I met with him in his office, of course, he brushed over the fact that there was no design studio, told me there was an amazing team, we're going to do all of these things, fantastic. And my assumption, of course, I thought through... secrecy, he's not going to take me there because I'm not working for him yet. So that's why I thought it was just in his office. And when I arrived, I went to his office straight away. We shook hands. He said, great. I'm glad you're here. And I said, so where's the design studio? And he looked at me and said, oh, we don't have a design studio. And I said, oh, well, we have the drawing office over here, and clay models. Oh, we can make clay models at Land Rover if we need to. So again, I then spent the time trying to figure out how we could get models created, and we were sharing a space in Land Rover studio, continuing because 06 we did the first show car for Rapide under Ford, and so it was a big rush then to organize, get clay modelers, get everything sorted to be able to deliver the car, which then became the production car as well.
May I suggest that the design studio is probably one of the biggest defining moments for Aston Martin, because up to then, which is quite surprising, they didn't have one. No. William Towne, to go back further, consultant. Callum worked at TWR. Fisker Ford.
Yeah, Fisker was BMW. Basically out of London.
Yeah.
So that was being worked out of a remote studio in London under Ford.
Virage was Heffernan Green again, consultants. Right. All the design was outside. It seems incredible. Aston Martin didn't have a studio.
And curiously enough, John Heffernan taught me and Ken Greenlee taught me at the RCA as well.
Oh, wonderful.
So they were my senior lecturer and one of the visiting professors. So
yeah.
That was interesting. So no, again,
clean sheet of paper.
Clean sheet of paper. And in 07, when we became, we were sold out of Ford, which is when Dave Richards joined as chairman with the consortium with the Kuwaitis. I submitted plans to the board to say, we need a design studio. So this design studio was commissioned in December of 2007. We had a brilliant opening party. By January of 08, we were fully functioning.
Really, that's a short period, isn't it?
Yeah, and amazing. The building itself is quite unbelievable because it's it was an Austrian builder, and it's all created from, as you can see, pine. And it was it's a fully sustainable building that was built from 9 weeks worth of growth in one of their high altitude pine forests, brought over on 42 trucks and assembled over a weekend. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. So, interesting fact.
Dr. Bett has told him it's going to be the weekend.
Well, interesting fact that obviously the site had to have all the groundworks done first, which was a relatively long amount of time. That's probably 6 weeks to get the groundworks done. And it runs from ground bore heating and cooling as well. So it's very, very environmental. But health and safety insisted that the building be surrounded by scaffolding. And the Austrian builders tried to explain to them that they would be quicker to erect the building than the scaffolders would to erect the scaffolding. But health and safety insisted and said, no, we must have scaffolding. So Friday afternoon, the scaffolders left with all the scaffolding on the floor. Friday evening, the truck started to arrive. On Monday morning, when the scaffolders turned up to put the scaffolding up, the building was erect.
Oh, perfect.
And honestly, there are some images of me in a hard hat up on here where my office is, fully built, but obviously none of the internals or the windows or the glazing done. But I watched them erect this building with precision, because it was all done off plan. It was all done to CAD drawing and then just assembled. It's a big Lego
as an
block.
Industrial designer, you must have been
I was in 7-7.
Yes,
yeah. And
it's not a car, but it's
yeah, it's working so closely with the architects, the builders, defining all the detail in through drawing first. So literally we did nothing on site. It was just assembled. And even if you look out there to the main showroom, the roof texture there, as you can see, that's all done. It's all machined, milled, and then slotted into place. So literally, the only thing they had to do in terms of decoration here was plaster the walls. So all of the plumbing, all of the electrics are already embedded in the walls, all the junctions, the unions in the floor to accept everything. They literally plastered and then painted, and it was done. And I have seriously never seen anything go up and be usable so quickly. It was amazing.
That is quite incredible. Holgaden site, such a transformation from that quaint Bloxham cottage, which suited it at the time.
Absolutely. And we used to say one of the big presentations that Ulrich had me involved in initially was we called it From Cottage to Cool, because in 2006, I think, 2007 and 2008, we were recognized as one of the coolest brands in the world.
Yes.
We won Cool Brands Award 3 times in the UK. And second to us at the time, imagine this now, second to Aston Martin was Apple. So we were voted coolest brand above Apple. It was, and that change was really important. That change from cottage to cool. You know, in Top Gear, we were in the cool fridge.
Yes.
We were in Clarkson's cool fridge.
Oh, yes. They had the cool, and they had the fridge at the end. Super cool, wasn't it?
We were in the cool fridge always.
Perfect. So,
in fact, I think DBS, the first DBS that put Daniel Craig as Bond back into our cars, also won Clarkson's Rear of the Year, which was one of my favorite. Well, I've got tons of awards, but that's still one of my favorite awards.
We're going to come to the cars in the moment, but I've always been fascinated. Aston Martins then were cool, and they probably still are now. A phrase may have gone in common usage. They're certainly beautiful. When do you think Aston Martins became like that? Because if you go back even pre-war, the DB456s, they were handsome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good looking.
Yeah.
But they never became beautiful. And what struck me, I read in recent Evo magazine, when the new Vanquish, the V12 Ferrari Cylindri.
Yeah, 12 Cylindri.
12 Cylindri. Lamborghini, it all parked up at a petrol station.
Yeah.
And it was the Aston Vanquish that was getting all the smartphone photos going from everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
When did you think Aston Martin became this defined as beautiful and cool?
Yeah, I think
it's a hard one.
well, I don't want to credit myself with that, but I have to a little bit. You're right. DB5 is handsome. It's a handsome car, and everybody knows it through Bond. Yes. So it's one of the most recognized car forms in the world. And if you start to analyze more of it, it does go beyond handsome because it has almost a perfect proportion. But it's simple. And generally, purity and simplicity don't equate to beauty. They equate to handsome, elegantly proportioned. And I would describe it as elegant. And what I wanted to put into the brand was beauty, was desire, was passion, was not just from a, whoa, that's very elegant, you must be a gentleman, driving it, to literally jaw-dropping, wow, what is that? And I think, you know, the car that was definitely beautiful but powerful was the DBS that yes. Daniel Craig drove. And that was, I think, was the beginning of that.
Do you think that? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably the, right.
The creating, actually maximizing proportion, maximizing the balance that a DB5 had, because it was wider than the DB9. It was lower. It looked more aggressive, assertive at the front. So like a stunning person, male or female, walks by, you can't help but stare and look. And so it was about giving the brand that impression and that image that we continued. And Rapide.
Yes.
I always have described it. It's the car that nobody imagines is a four-door. And my interpretation of Rapide from the very first instance, the very first sketches I was sending to Ulrich, were of a racehorse in flight. So a racehorse when a racehorse is standing, it's a DB5. When a racehorse is galloping and running, it's a Rapide. Right. The sinuous nature of it, it's showing its prowess and power. And from then on, that's what I always wanted our cars to portray. And I think you describe Vanquish absolutely, it's the Instagram car, because it's just stunningly beautiful in the flesh.
Yeah.
And
Do you think people understand, they know something beautiful, when they see something beautiful, they don't necessarily know why.
But nature tells our brains what beauty is. There's a golden rule, a golden proportion, Fibonacci's law, which tells our brain something is beautiful. And it's a mathematical law. We can't resist it. And we didn't create it. Artists discovered it. And Leonardo da Vinci talked very much about it. And it's the law of proportionality. And when you get that proportion correct in relationship, then you have a beautiful object. And I remember launching Rapide actually in Japan. And we had an audience of about 150 people, some press, so journalists, press, customers, dealers, etc., artists and creators. And I did my presentation about beauty and golden proportion, Fibonacci's law. And being Japan, a gentleman in the audience was actually measuring the car. And after the presentation, he sent me an image of the Rapide fitted to golden proportion and said, "You are right, it does fit." I think from that moment on, I've realized that designers have this innate ability to spot great proportions.
Yes.
Because I didn't go and measure.
No.
It's all a visual. It's a visual process. So actually someone measured it and said, yes, you're right. And it's the rule, if you look at the rule, it's roughly a one-third to two-third proportional relationship. So length of hood versus cabin, the size of the door versus the glass, all of those things give you perfect proportion. And our cars always have it. In the next generation, we have to push beyond that, because you might argue now beauty's not enough. Beauty is a fantastic thing to have, but we now need to shout with our beauty as well. And I think if you look at some of the latest product, Vanquish is beautiful, but it's incredibly powerful on the road as well. I mean, it's got probably the biggest face we've ever produced on road.
Nice backside as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And something like Valkyrie and Valhalla, they are performance orientated product that have oodles of aerodynamic influence as well, which gives them that overtness that is not just purely about beauty. There's an overt nature to them as well.
It's fascinating that you consider that the DBS and the Rapide has been probably the stepping stone for beauty for the Aston Martins. Of course, as some context at that time, when you came in the design studio, we had the first generation V8 Vantage and the DB9. So these cars that you were beginning to introduce, they were variations of the models to extend the portfolio.
Correct.
We weren't getting into to the next core product, which I think would be DB11, but that's under Andy Palmer. That's the next era, which we'll come onto later.
The one that was seminal and in that period, though, was 177.
I was about to say
so that. So 177
it seems to get forgotten.
Yeah, 2010, I think we took it to Villa d'Este. There's a trophy somewhere. Those two are such Villa d'Este winner
such
trophies.
Such a good-looking car.
Yeah, and it's when you see one now, its proportion is so dramatic, absolutely dramatic. You know, many, many firsts for us. The first time we'd done a carbon fiber monocoque tub, it was a brand new, uniquely developed V12 engine from Cosworth and ourselves. The drivetrain and the gearbox, you know, it was an automated manual gearbox as well, so very close to DCT in terms of its shift patterns. A lot of technology through carbon, aluminium exterior, very, very few shut lines, such drama in the car. And it's hard to explain what B surface and A surface means, but every surface in the car, and what I mean by A and a B surface, an A surface is something you can touch, the bonnet, the fenders, the interior, the steering wheels. A B surface are the hidden surfaces under the bonnet. As the door opens, those closure areas.
All right.
The ethos behind 177 was to make every single surface, and this is the industrial designer in me, an A surface. So if you ever see a 177, open the doors, pop the hood, it's immaculate. There is nothing where you would say, oh, well, they didn't think about that bit. We intended to have every single part of the car. A is a dual purpose, so it saves a lot of weight. So the way the air comes in, breathes in, cools the car, breathes the engine, actually flows into the Y section underneath the hood and into the cabin for cooling as well. So there were not extraneous parts. Everything was basically engineered and created and designed for efficiency, light in weight, and performance. Even the fact that there is no spoiler on the car, but it was, I think, a 221 mile an hour car, I want to say, and it had an air spoiler.
Really,
that came
at that
up.
Time?
Yeah.
What was the motivation behind the car?
It was to showcase Aston Martin. It was to show a new era.
Yeah.
So this was as you said, you know, the prior cars, if you like, were continuing to evolve the portfolio from Vantage and DB9. This was the new era of car, and it was about new technologies. It was also, at the time, the most expensive car in the world, because we were there before Bugatti, and we did 77 of them. They sold through the economic crisis as well. So the world went through its economic crash. We still sold all of the cars. And it became the inspiration later on for DB11 and a lot of the language that you see today. So it really was a very, very important car in the company's history.
So in the Betts era, what cars would you suggest are flag up there? I think it must be the DBS and the 177.
Yeah, DBS, absolutely. Because James Bond not driving an Aston Martin, can you imagine it now? And before DBS, he was not. He was driving a BMW.
Yeah.
And that put us on the map again, and it made Daniel Craig as James Bond part of his character and makeup. And that's a huge thing, because culturally, you become a pop icon. So I think, you know, DBS and that kind of synonymous relationship with Bond was really important from a brand perspective. And we are the longest brand association in any movie with Bond. It's over 60 years. We celebrated 60 years last year.
Yeah.
And then 177, because of technology and change and just the ethos of how to make a car and what performance is. But I would have to throw Rapide in because it was a first foray into four doors.
Again, that's, you don't hear much of them. They are an underrated car. They are such a cracking car.
And I've had such good journeys across. Yes. I'm a big skier and you know, had many Rapides, put winter tires on them. And it's amazing where you can drive them up a mountain. Mm. And I've had people in 4x4s shocked looking at me driving up the side of a mountain going, that's an Aston Martin sports car. And the only downside, obviously, is you're very, very close to the ground. But brilliant cars, absolutely brilliant cars.
How would you look back on the Betts era? When Betts left, I think there was a bit of a lull between finding another CEO.
Yeah.
And chairman.
About
and
then 18 Andy, months.
Yeah, it was a long time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think you had a finance guy running a shop for a while.
Well, it was myself and Hanno, actually. Oh, right. So we kind of had joint control, if you like, reporting directly into the shareholders. But by then, the shareholding had split from only being Kuwaitis to being Kuwaitis and the Italians, Industrial. So that was interesting. And, you know, Ulrich, Dr. Betts, I'll refer to Ulrich as Dr. Betts because he deserves it. You know, he was inspirational in developing the platform ethos we still use today.
Yes.
So bonded aluminium structures that are simple, allow a great amount of flexibility, not a huge amount of investment. This factory was built under Ulrich's leadership.
Mm.
The whole process and ethos, which, again, as I mentioned, we still use today, came from his desire to create lightweight sporting structures. We went back to racing under Ulrich.
Yes, indeed.
So we went back to Le Mans. We started.
And you're a bit of a good petrol as well.
I'm a bit of a gentleman driver, a lot of GT4 racing.
I always ask this question, because fortunately I've interviewed David Richards, I spoke to Andy Palmer, and I'm speaking to you, all been GT4 racers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always ask them who was the best driver.
Two seconds faster than Andy. And I specifically remember, particularly with DR, I think he was partnering with Christian Horner at a race somewhere. We did a GT4 challenge race. And my race partner, I think, was Ollie Marriage from Top Gear, and we beat them. So, I mean.
Okay, I better check my notes because I'm sure they said they were better.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm sure they said it.
A mistake.
Yeah.
I'll get them to correct. I'll speak to them and see what they say.
But, you know, any racing driver is never going to say they're slowest, are they? But I also race a DB24 as well.
Yes.
So I have a very handsome,
a few times.
Yeah, DB24, which is, she is wonderful. Three owners from New, and just a great character. Absolutely, the DB24 defines what an Aston Martin is as well, because it is at the time, let's call it handsome, but practical, usable, incredibly. Given it's a 54 car, and I've driven many times to Le Mans in the car, no problem whatsoever. Just in terms of, you know, your feet aching, your butt aching, etc. It's a great car to do a long tour in.
Would that be your car outside your era, if you like, if you had to go back and say that's my favorite?
Probably
Aston,
would be the
for a core production model.
Yeah, exactly. As core production, I mean, DBR1, I can't help but say.
Well, I'll fight you for a DB3S.
Yeah, I think the one, not just because it won Le Mans, but purely because I think the 3S has an emotion, but there is a control to it. Whereas I find DBR1s just flamboyant, completely. There's no rationale. There is no control. It's just a sensual object. And every time, and I was fortunate enough to drive a car, one of the cars at Le Mans when we celebrated 20 odd years of winning. So, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's wrap this up.
Yeah.
That's the Betts here. Do you still hear from Dr. Betts?
I do, yes.
Does he tell you what you're doing wrong?
Yeah, he does, absolutely. Yeah, I saw him recently. And in fact, I've just had an email from Anne, one of his daughters, who would like one of the prams. So that the family still loves Aston Martin, which is brilliant.
That is brilliant. Perfect. Great. I thoroughly enjoyed that. We'll meet again. we go to some other areas, and one I'm looking at on my list is the Palmer area. And I think, well, we need to put some time aside for that, because a lot went on in that period, didn't it?
It did, okay. Absolutely.
But in the meantime, Marek, thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast. Discover more about the story of Aston Martin, the cars, the people, the history, with the Aston Martin Heritage Trust. You're always welcome to visit us at our museum in Oxfordshire. So find out more via amht.org.uk.